Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. For months, we've been talking about how the novel coronavirus pandemic is holding up a mirror to the reality of life in the United States. Well, every 4 years, we get another kind of mirror, a funhouse mirror, if you will, of a political party's stage-managed, media-massaged vision for the country.
I'm here at this convention because I profoundly believe that present basic trends and perils are rushing us toward a national crisis.
Mayor, do you think the news media have treated you fairly in this matter, or the whole convention being here?
I don't worry about whether they treat me fairly or squarely. Mayor, I know that if you do what's right, you don't have to worry about the television medium or any other medium.
Read my lips.
I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible.
Moments there from presidential nominating conventions from 1964 through 2004. But of course, this is 2020, and this year is very different. The pandemic has stripped away all pretense from American life and revealed a fragile nation. It has shown us inescapably what this country is. And in the face of that, this week and next, America's two political parties will show you what they believe this country should be. For the next 2 weeks, we'll be closely examining the platforms, the people from the bottom of the party to the top, and of course, the nominees in both parties as they present themselves once again to the American people in their nominating conventions. And today, on day one of the Democratic National Convention, we're going to start with the shape and story of this convention itself. The pandemic has scoured away most pretense for this event, too. No balloon drop, no arena full of thousands of fervent delegates. Instead, the Democrats are planning what could amount to a week-long political Zoom infomercial. It could be voters' best chance in a generation to set aside distraction and listen closely to the nominees. Or it could be an endless virtual spin room, perfectly suited for the social media age. So how will Joe Biden and the Democratic Party try to tell their story? Well, joining us today is a veteran journalist who covered many conventions. Dan Rather was a journalist with CBS News, of course, from 1962 to 2006, including years as anchor of the CBS Evening News. He is the author of many books, including What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan Rather, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you, Meghna.
So I want to talk a little bit in a moment about 1968 as sort of a way to measure what 2020 might be like. But let's just first start with the present. I mean, Dan, if you were charged with covering this convention, this unconventional convention, how would you go about doing it?
Well, first of all, I'd get a very hot and big pot of coffee on. Secondly, I would settle back in and say to myself, don't be cynical, be accepting, take everything in, and recognize that this is so different this year that, look, we're all in uncharted territory. Nobody's ever had a virtual convention before. What I'd be looking for, among other things, is how much attention this actually gets. Is anybody out there in America, very many people, actually watching and listening to this? You know, first of all, this is a very difficult thing put together. They almost, well, I wouldn't say certainly, but with this much spread out, people coming from different places, glitches, things that don't work are bound to be a factor. And answer your question, what I'm looking for, you know, how well does the party put forward its message that as we begin this week at the conventions, what we have is, you know, the Democrats are trying to put forward a message of we're reaching into the past with Joe Biden, reaching into the future with Kamala Harris. So we're the party of both the past and the future. With the Republicans' message, whether they intend it or not, is that their party has become completely, fully the party of Trump. Now, the Democrats are going to try to make their message this week. That's the choice the country has. We'll see how effectively they can do that.
Well, let's go back then to the 68 convention, because, of course, I mean, it's almost, excuse me, Dan, I'm just going to like stop myself in the middle of this question, because it's almost not worth making the comparison because there will be no people together. I just want to underscore that point. However, the mood of the country, the fragile nature of American democracy, I think we've had historical echoes, and 68 would be one of them. So I just want to play a moment from the 1968 Democratic convention. You were possibly one of the most visible correspondents on the floor of the convention. I mean, here's one moment, one very raucous and historic moment when you were on the floor of the Democratic convention, and of course, the legendary Walter Cronkite, then anchor of the CBS Evening News, was telling the live audience watching what was happening.
What's your name, sir? And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me. Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please. I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you plan to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walter, as you can see,
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan. And obviously getting roughed up.
And then Dan, just a few moments later on live TV, here's what you reported.
I'm sorry to be out of breath, but somebody belted me in his stomach doing that. What happened is a Georgia delegate, at least he had a Georgia delegate sign on, was being hauled out of the hall. We tried to talk to him to see why, who he was, and what the situation was. And at that instant, the security people, well, as you can see, put me on the deck. I didn't do very well.
I think we've got a bunch of thugs here, Dan.
Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather in 1968, of course, in Chicago. Now, Dan, can you just, are there echoes that you think in terms of the mood of the country? Because outside of the convention in Chicago, there was protests and tear gas in the street. Inside, obviously, as we heard, chaos as well. Any lessons that you could draw that we might apply here in 2020?
Well, I do agree that there are some similarities with 2020 and 1968 in terms of demonstrations in the streets, the country being at odds with itself, so to speak. But on the other hand, this is a whole new century. It's a different time, and in many ways, almost a different country. It's hard to make too close a parallel in that, for one thing, at the convention, at the Democratic convention, this was, you know, the country in some ways showing itself to the world at its worst, and the whole world was watching. That, as you pointed out, there were demonstrations, protests outside the convention hall in Chicago, and then there was an insurgent movement inside the hall, and what happened in that piece that you played with Walter Cronkite and myself was there was such an effort to keep control inside the convention hall that actually violence was being used against convention delegates as well as to reporters. But what we can learn from it is that no matter how bad things look at any given time, this country does have the ability, a tremendous ability, to be resilient and to pick itself almost literally up off the floor and, you know, get back, which we did after 1968 in the turbulent 60s. Now, I don't want that to sound like some kind of fuzzy-headed, well, everything's going to be all right optimism that each generation has to demonstrate it anew. But in answer to your question, what we can learn from 68 The country can be extremely divided, but it also has the capacity to pull itself back together and reunite. Whether that will be the case now as we move quickly now into the third decade of the 21st century is one of the things that will be part of the background for these political conventions.
Hmm. And so then what would you say in more detail, Dan, if I may, is the role of journalism then in terms of extracting what that dialogue is about how the country picks itself up? How could journalists, should journalists best do that both this week and next for both conventions?
Well, it's a big responsibility for journalism and journalists. But in answer to your question, I think number one, simply put, journalists should just do the job, just do the damn job. And the job is to be honest brokers of information, to put forward what the party wants people to hear, and then to connect the dots, if you will, report what has happened, what's being said, and then connect those dots into responsible analysis and get as close to the truth as it's humanly possible and stand and tell it. That's the best that journalists can do. Journalists can't solve all the problems, but they can give people the information. We can give people the information they need. But there's one thing, Meghna, that I think we should point out that we'll be finding out this week and then later at the Republican convention whether people will pay attention to these so-called virtual conventions. I have some concern that particularly with the pandemic and the economic situation being what it is, that you may not have as many people watching and listening to the conventions as you would have if the conventions were their, if you will, spectacular showmanship self. We're about to find out, but I do have some concern whether enough people would tune in the conventions to make them the kickoff to the real campaign that we generally expect them to be.
Well, we are talking this hour about day one in this decidedly unconventional Democratic National Convention. Legendary newsman Dan Rather joins us. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's day one of the Democratic National Convention, and we're talking about what we're likely to see today and who's likely to watch it. I'm joined by legendary newsman Dan Rather. He's with us this hour. And also joining us now is David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent and On Point Friday host and editor. David, hello.
Hey, Meghna. Good to hear your voice.
You too. So you heard Dan there a couple of times actually say that one of his largest concerns is how many people are going to be paying attention to the DNC as it unfolds in whatever way it might. Do you share that concern?
I think people have a right to tune in as much or as little as they want. I do think that is, you know, as Dan suggests, an opportunity for the parties to sharpen their message, convey their agenda, present what they say they want the country to look like moving forward, and you'd like Americans to tune in as part of their civic duty. But these things are, you know, as we know, largely spectacle. There's rarely hard news that comes out of these things, occasionally a tussle over language about abortion in this convention or civil rights in that convention. And maybe there would be something like that this time around, given all the social tumult we've had over the last 6 months, weren't for the fact that we've all been, you know, largely shuttered in our homes. I do think that the challenge is going to be, are there going to be viral moments that almost reverse engineer audience by getting people to see it on social media, share it on social media, and perhaps then be stimulated to tune in? But, you know, we haven't heard that much from, if you think about this week, from Michelle and Barack Obama, a little bit here and there. It'll be interesting to see what they do with that. Those are very strong draws. Be interesting to see what John Kasich, the former Republican governor of Ohio, a longtime member of Congress, a budget official, you know, what he does when he speaks to Democrats crossing the aisle to do that. There will be – it'll be interesting to see Senator Kamala Harris. So there will be moments that will almost provoke or inspire a certain degree of attention, and I think social media will help fuel that. The other thing is there isn't a lot of original programming on. You know, there's a lot of stuff on Netflix and Hulu and other things you can find, but, you know, original programming is hard to come by. There is some professional sports, but people may tune to it simply because it's one of the better shows on.
Yeah. Well, Dan, let me just turn back to you for a second because, you know, let's focus on the 21st century and the Democratic conventions that we have seen so far. I mean, to David's point, there have been sort of some breakout moments in 2004, you know, Barack Obama's first like really big national speech as then senator. In 2016, we had sort of the culmination of the intra-party battles between sort of the Clinton and Sanders wings of the Democratic Party. We had been seeing that, though, in the primary season prior to that. So there were sort of a couple of revealing moments, let's say, about what the Democratic Party was in that particular nominating year. But did it necessarily amount to news? I mean, you had mentioned earlier that we shouldn't be cynical about the party convention. And maybe you were responding to my introduction to this hour, which was laden with more than a little bit of cynicism. I'll be perfectly honest, Dan. It's hard not to be cynical because where is the news in these conventions?
Well, I agree. It's hard not to be cynical, which is one reason I was cautioning myself and other journalists to beware of cynicism and to go into it with an open mind. You know, I'd be curious to see the Democrats. They have some opportunities here to sort of crack through the glass, as people inside television sometimes call it, and to provide a memorable moment. And in a moment, we'll sort of catch fire, if you will, on social media, things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. For example, tonight, which is the opening night, of course, of the Democratic Convention, Michelle Obama has a tremendous following. She has a very positive image in the country as a whole. You know, a terrific Michelle Obama speech could mean a lot to this convention. So one of the questions tonight is, well, she's batting cleanup. She has the prime spot between, you know, the climatic spot between 10 and 11 p.m. Eastern time zone. And, you know, she in the past has often delivered big time when there are a lot of chips on the table, so to speak. It'll be, you know, among tonight's storylines, is she able to do that again in this, you know, weird virtual convention format? I think she has the ability to do so. As I say, it'll be one of the storylines I'm watching tonight.
And David, what do you think?
I think that's right. You know, I talked with folks from NBC News for a story I did for Morning Edition about the challenges they face. And it became clear that there are these sort of concurrent and diametrically opposed challenges for the parties of at once conveying grandeur and intimacy at the same time. you know, they're supposed to be like events that require like a magnetic gravitational force, your attention, and compel you to get swept up in the moment and carried away. It's harder to do that. You know, I don't see them doing things like they do for Major League Baseball, where they cut out pictures of delegates, put them in there and pipe in, pipe in applause. Right. So it's harder to get swept up if you're these little isolated nomads, right, watching in scattered 100 million homes around the country. But it's possible with the power of rhetoric. We've just got to see how that plays out. Also, the question of intimacy, the idea that suddenly it's she's talking only to you or former President Obama or whomever they've brought in, talking really to you in a way that touches you and stirs you and moves you, either convinces you to do something or compels you to act upon what you already believe. That's something that requires an intimacy that television is very good for and teleconferencing less so. And so we're going to see how that works as well. It is a real rhetorical, I think, challenge. It's an extra layer of it. And so I think you're going to see a lot of people on both sides working hard to figure out how to surmount that.
I'll be especially interested to see how that plays in on Thursday when former Vice President Biden will be speaking, because you know, he's famously a man who feeds off the energy of making that personal connection, whether it be with one person or an arena full of 10,000 people. And he'll just be speaking to a camera from Delaware. It might also be an opportunity for him, and David, to your point about that intimacy, making sort of that one-to-one connection through the screen. So who knows? I mean, this is all unprecedented. But Dan, I know I've got to let you go in 2 minutes here. So just one more question for you. You said that you told us that Michelle Obama, the former first lady, is one of the things that you're going to be paying particular attention to tonight. What else are you going to be watching for over the course of the week?
Well, Bernie Sanders will be speaking sometime before Michelle Obama. And if you will, he's the second speaker of most interest to me. Does Bernie Sanders, does he deliver for the party now? And even if he delivers a terrific speech, a great unity speech, how many of his followers and supporters will really line up, in effect, metaphorically line up behind him? That Sanders could, if he's capable of making a very impassioned speech, and one that will move his followers to, first of all, get to the polls, and secondly, be sure they vote for the Biden-Harris ticket. But Sanders, at the last convention, he spoke up for Hillary Clinton, but there were a lot of disaffected Sanders supporters who didn't deliver at the polls in the last election. So Sanders will be worth watching tonight. I know that he has a reputation of boring people because he sometimes descends into a kind of arm-waving professor style that a lot of people don't watch. But I would say second on my list of interest tonight would be Sanders, to see what he says, how he says it, and whether it really helps unite the party or not.
Well, Dan Rather was with CBS News for 44 years, from 1962 to 2006, author of several books, including What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan Rather, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
David, I'd love to hear more from you about the challenges around covering this convention, because, you know, the cable news channels, we can talk about them more in a second, but I'm guessing they're going to do wall-to-wall coverage. The networks are going to handle this differently. And they've been, reducing their coverage of conventions every 4 years or so, it seems. However, I also read a high-level Democratic operative saying that network coverage of conventions is still one of the best ways to reach persuadable independence. So how important, I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, how important is how the networks cover these conventions?
Look, they're diminished in the ambition of what they want to do. They're diminished in how long they provide audience, and they're diminished in the audience size itself, right? And at the same time, they are not as identified with a party or an ideology or the idea of being easily discounted because their personalities, as in the case of CNN, have distinct kind of positions or CNN, look, MSNBC is clearly an anti-Trump a sounding board and a platform for anti-Trump folks, even as it also incorporates reporting from NBC News' news division. Fox News is a wholeheartedly conservative outfit that happens to have real reporters who work there as well. And it varies from adamantly pro-Trump to sometimes willing to question Trump. And the opinion, the folks in the cable outfits are assigned by viewers often to home teams in a way that even while there are critiques of the old school broadcast networks of ABC, NBC, CBS, it's just harder to pigeonhole. And therefore, the person that you talk to is probably getting at the idea that there is a patina of reliability of straighter ahead news, of less ideologically filtered coverage that attends to that. Now, let's also be clear that NBC has MSNBC and has multiple, Telemundo, CNBC is in there as well, but it also has multiple digital platforms it provides things on. CBS has had some success with its streaming channel, CBSN. ABC has gotten into the game with its streaming channel. So each of them is providing a lot more coverage and taking advantage of its reporters than ever to do more. People are going to have to seek those out, and those are much more modest audiences. I think the real challenge, right, and forgive me for continuing on this, but the real challenge in some ways to my mind is not only the question of programming it as a spectacle, right? I mean, they're called, as we call them at NPR, they're called TV producers because it's language appropriated from Broadway. And you got to put on a visual spectacle or something compelling to get people to keep watching. And that's going to be hard. But there's also a difficulty on the journalistic side, which is when, I've been to a few conventions, and when there are thousands of people milling about, you've got delegates, you've got political pros, you've got senior party figures, elected officials, lobbyists, and journalists all together in this huge arena and the many, many, many hotels and bars and restaurants and parks around it, you're going to get information. And if you're working from home or a heavily cleansed remote studio, it is much harder to have that human commerce that allows you to extract some of the tensions behind the scenes. We're all doing it now by text or Signal or whatever. So there are ways of trying to approximate that, but less happens. And so I think journalistically, it's going to be a harder slog for journalists to break things off. People are going to have to plan more consciously what stories they're going after and are less likely to uncover things as lanyap, right? As an unexpected joy that you stumble across, because you're not going to be bouncing off other people who are like, I cannot believe what just happened. Let me fill you in about what this governor just pulled.
Yeah. You know, I'm actually really glad that you made that point, David, because I would say that the great reporters are able to extract that novel information in the midst of the hubbub of a convention. How much of that information actually gets to the public, I'm not so sure of. I mean, my personal experience of conventions has left me, frankly, to be a little cynical about it, because I'm also suspect about the quality of the information to come out of a convention, because it is so heavily stage managed. The theater of it I've found to be quite distracting and disappointing. And so one of the things that I'm actually quite looking forward to is the absence, funnily enough, the absence of all that. Now, because is this an opportunity for the media, for journalists to say, well, let's really actually focus on what's in the platform. Let's really actually focus on specifically what Bernie Sanders is saying to his primary supporters, and what that effect might have on the general election as the country moves forward. I wonder if there's an opportunity here that we haven't had in previous conventions.
Yeah, and that's certainly what NBC News President Noah Oppenheim said to me last week. He said this is an opportunity to kind of break with past practices and traditions, and focus more on the substance of giving people the information they need to make the vote that they want to cast, which is really at the heart of the civic point of journalism, is to equip people to be citizens. And that's admirable, and I'll be interested to see how that plays out. It might be virtue by necessity, or it might be, as you say, taking advantage of an opportunity to do that. A lot of the reporting that got done in conventions in the past, if not heavily sculpted to be spin, was often kind of incremental infighting stuff that distracted you from the larger issues. So, there is that. The real issue at times, though, is that sometimes the party platforms themselves are a hodgepodge, are glossing over major issues, are talking about issues that are easier to talk about than the ones that are tougher and more germane because those issues are tough. And so focusing on what the parties want you to focus on can itself be complicated. I do think it's an opportunity for serious news organizations to say, here are the parties, here are the serious issues before the nation, and here are how they propose handling and addressing them. And you know, when those things aren't spoken to explore that as well and figure out why and figure out what that means. I think that, you know, this is a consequential election. These are two, even if Joe Biden is well-known, well-worn, and a centrist Democrat, these are two very different visions of America. And, you know, the nation needs to understand both the details of that and that fact as well. And, yeah. You know, I think that it's incumbent on journalists to find out ways to explore that. You know, I always like the metaphor, and forgive me for going back to sports, but you know, when Bill Bradley was written about as a young basketball star at Princeton, the New Yorker wrote this wonderful piece in which they talked about how he always knew what to do away from the ball. He knew where to move. He knew where to go. Well, journalists, this is a wonderful opportunity to go away from the ball and let the speeches be analyzed and carefully, rigorously fact-checked, and as well as the rhetoric, but also figure out, okay, and where's the nation headed? What's not being addressed here? What are people actually thinking about? What are people considering? What's happening with their lives? We're facing layer upon layer of crises affecting Americans that you know, we explore on point all the time. You know, where are the parties and what are they doing to deal with these things?
Yeah. Well, we are talking about what will unfold this week in the Democratic National Convention, a virtual convention, by virtue, if I could put it that way, of the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic. David Folkenflik is with me this hour. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is the week of the Democratic National Convention. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the Democrats' party platform, laying out the policies that the Democratic Party wishes to pursue on everything from managing the pandemic to the economy to housing, healthcare, criminal justice. If you've taken a look at the Democratic Party platform this year, is there anything in it that excites you? Are there issues that you feel the Democrats have left out? Are they being big, bold, and ambitious enough? Or do you think the party platform overpromises and overreaches? We want to hear from you, so leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow when we talk about the Democrats' party platform. Today, we're talking about the shape of this unconventional virtual convention, and NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is here with us to talk about it. David, we talked a little bit about the network's coverage, their sort of curtailed primetime coverage. Of course, the total flip side to that is cable news coverage, which will it be wall-to-wall, even with this virtual format, David?
Pretty much. You know, I mean, I was reminded during the break of, I think it was 1996, I may be getting the date wrong, when Ted Koppel walked out of a convention in San Diego, basically saying, there's no news here. He's like, forget it. We're out. And, you know, in today's cable world, you know, this is free programming for them. It's a It's a topic to talk about endlessly with new, put it in quotes, content as new speakers come up. And every time somebody fails to be inspiring or particularly interesting, they'll cut away and their analysts will dissect it and say what it means in this precinct in Ohio or that, you know, county in Florida, and cut it to size. And then people will dissect, you know, the policies and the implications. You know, Jan Rather talked about Bernie Sanders. I think she gets a very brief bite at the apple, but, you know, I think a lot of people are going to be very interested to hear what AOC has to say. And some of the younger, you know, more progressive, more left of center members of the party and of the House who have really provided new energy and new wind and ballast for this party being led by such a centrist. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing to tease out. And I think that analysts will just dissect that for hours, you know, and that's what they do. And they do it to play for a home team, but they also do it because they're of the belief that you don't tune in all day. You tune in for 15, 20 minutes at a time. And so even if it's somewhat repetitive to people like you and me who might watch several hours for work, it's not how Americans experience it. Well, to be fair, it is kind of how Americans experience it on weeks like this. They watch for longer stretches if they're invested in politics during weeks of elections, of conventions. These are moments that America kind of agrees are going to be spent on hashing through what the parties think they stand for and what message they want to present to the public. And you're seeing it kind of play out in this way. So yes, I think cable, you will see endless dissection. And then, you know, on social media, of course, you see even more minute gratings, almost like shavings of a clove of garlic. You know, right. It gets thinner and thinner slices, but it gets at something and it may catch hold. And then that fuels what cable news talks about for 8 minutes at a stretch. So they, you know, they're, again, one of their challenges is usually they have guests planned. They've hired a flotilla of people who have held previous roles in administrations or campaigns of both parties. You know, I think that's a complicated business practice or ethical practice, but they do it to make sure they have the fish tank well stocked. And then they usually see people in the hustings and they send producers out to sort of grab somebody by the elbow and say, hey, do you mind standing by for about 15, 20 minutes? We're going to want to pop you on the air. And those people come and talk about their viewpoints or perspectives, whether regional or ideological or what have you. And that adds to the broadcast too. A lot tougher to do when those people are all at home. So that's going to be a challenge as well. Things are going to have to be done with much more intentionality here.
Yeah. Well, let's hear for a few minutes from someone who's actually stood on a convention stage and given a speech in a convention past. Bakari Sellers is a CNN political commentator and attorney, a former state representative in South Carolina. And let's listen to a portion of Bakari's speech at the Democratic National Convention from 2016.
Stand up for Black Lives Matter. Stand up for progress. Stand up for justice. And stand up if you know, like I know, that we're stronger together. Thank you, and God bless America.
Bakari Sellers in 2016 at the DNC, and the former state representative joins us now from Denmark, South Carolina. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me ask you, you've stood on that stage. You felt the energy of the thousands of people in the arena. And I think that energy really matters because television is what it is. It's a very, in a sense, it's a very unforgiving medium, right? Someone's speech can be beautifully written but fall flat because there's something about the affect of the speaker that's not really landing well, and maybe that has to do with the energy she or he is or isn't feeling from the crowd. So in the absence of that this year, is there a really big risk of the former vice president or Senator Harris or any one of the speakers over the next 4 days, Mr. Sellers, like just kind of coming across like, you know, a manager in a Zoom meeting or your doctor in a telemedicine appointment?
Let's hope not. I don't believe that's the case because these things are going to be so well produced. Some of them are recorded, some are live. You know, I know Bernie Sanders' speech today is about 8 minutes long. And when you just think about how well produced this is going to be, I don't anticipate anybody falling flat. But to your point, I must say that that energy from the crowd, that fervor that you get. I was able to look out. I gave my speech at about 5:30 in the evening. It was covered live on CNN, but I was able to look out and see the South Carolina delegates, and they had my name spelled with a little sign. They had Bakari Sellers spelled throughout the auditorium. There's thousands of people in there, and it just feels so good that it pushes you and motivates you to kind of give the best oratory possible. And so this is going to be vastly different. Even the Republican convention last year, where Donald Trump kind of came in and during the middle or near the end of Ted Cruz's speech, like it was WrestleMania, and kind of hovered down from on high. You can't have those type of settings with these virtual events. So the production has to be A1.
The production has to be A1. But what about the impact of the message itself? I mean, it seems like what is the Democrats' message for this week for its potential voters?
So, yeah, and I think that we will formulate that kind of throughout the week, and the tone is going to be set by Michelle Obama. You know, the difficult part for me, though, is I just think back to last year's convention where we – well, not last year, 2016's convention where we had an amazing convention where Michelle gave the when they go low, we go high speech. Barack Obama's speech was amazing. Hillary Clinton accepted the nomination for the first time. We had a female at the top of the ticket. So with all of those things, even coming out of that with the huge bump, we the presidential race, in many races down ballot, we thought we were going to win. And so I'm just cautiously optimistic, even with the pageantry of this week. Whatever message we portray, we have to make sure that the most urgent message that we do is that everybody needs to get out and vote. Everybody must vote. Like their life depends on it, because it truly does. I think that what you're going to get from Democrats this week is a sense of urgency unlike any sense of urgency we felt in politics before.
I have to say I'm a little surprised to hear you say whatever message the Democrats convey. Shouldn't there be a sharper, more defined edge to that by now?
Well, I think that what you're seeing is a unique time where we have three pandemics or three serious issues that are facing the American people. One, you have coronavirus and the response to it. Two, you have the economic impact of the coronavirus. And three, you have the racial reckoning that we're going through. These are very unique times. And so we'll have messages that directly talk about those three issues that are facing and afflicting the American people in three different ways. The unifying message around all of those things, though, I'm just highlighting to you is that sense of urgency that's felt by all. You'll hear Joe Biden say things like our better days are ahead. But in order to get to that point, everyone has to get on their horse, their proverbial horse, and again, do everything possible to go out and vote this November.
Mm-hmm. So, David, jump in here. Do you think that communicating that sense of urgency is going to be possible given the sort of the strictures of this virtual convention?
You know, I think it very much depends on the rhetoric, the eloquence, the intelligence, the magnetism of those doing the presenting. I mean, obviously, Bakari right there is appealing to the youth vote and pandering there. But, you know, I would say that I think it is possible. I think we've heard Oval Office speeches that were, you know, essentially done with a couple of aides in the room over a variety of presidencies at critical moments that could move the nation. You saw it on civil rights. JFK did that. I think Lyndon Johnson did that. President Reagan, I believe, did a version of that from the White House after the Challenger shuttle exploded in the sky. I think it's possible, but I think those tend to be really compelling, transcendent moments. Would Barack Obama's 2004 speech to the Democratic Convention there in Boston been as compelling if he had done it from an anteroom or a screened-in mm-hmm. porch at his home? I don't know, but it was a pretty impressive speech, and it did gain incredible urgency, and it accelerated, and the pace just you know, just from a rhetorical standpoint was, and the content standpoint was amazing to witness and watch this star emerge in public in so prominent a way. You've got to believe that something on that level would burst through the TV screen, even if done, if produced in, well, remotely. But it is more of a challenge to do it without, as Picard Sellers was telling us from his own firsthand experience, without almost a you know, being lifted up by the crowd as though in a wave, right? You've got to do it on his or her own power, and that's just a bit of a tougher lift.
I would actually say that it's a much, much tougher lift that I too, David, was there in 04, and you could see how then-Senator Obama was absolutely, you know, the lift being lifted by the wave of the audience's energy. Yeah, it was a great, I mean, it's a great analogy. That's exactly what was happening. And you could, the resonance of that moment was absolutely filtered through how people were responding to him, which we're just not going to really have in any comparable way this time around. But Kari, let me just turn back to you for a second, because so we talked about your experience in terms of what it's like standing on that stage, but this time around, you're also going to be covering the convention as a commentator for yeah. CNN. So how are you going to do that as a member of the commentariat this time?
Well, I'm going to be a lot more sober because we won't actually be at the convention. We won't have the fun that is surrounding the convention. I mean, people really miss that camaraderie. You know, those late nights with Terry McAuliffe up at the hotel bar, just sharing stories. You get a chance to see the campaign managers. We were hanging out with Pluff and Messina. We're going to miss all of those because I'm doing all the commentary from my home, my little home studio. Like many people. And so not being on the floor with the audience around you, we had Crow's Nest in 2016. In 2016, some of the shows we actually did from the floor of the bowl. I mean, it was just, you could feel that energy through the screen. And to both of you guys' point, we're not going to have that. And so kind of the pageantry and the production of the moment is what we're going to have to go by. And that's going to be difficult. That's extremely difficult to overcome. I think the difference between this week and next week, however, though, is that we have proven orators. We have individuals who have that talent that we were discussing earlier, who can cut through a screen, even in a well-produced type of scenario. When you're talking about Barack Obama, when you're talking about Michelle Obama, even when you're talking about Bill Clinton or AOC, all of these individuals are very talented orators. I believe Kamala Harris is on that same plateau. And so I think that we're going to have a few moments this week that have the ability to cut through. Hopefully we'll be able to capture them on CNN and everywhere else, given this very, very strange time.
Well, I would argue that next week the Republicans have one of the most talented orators anywhere in America in the form of the president, given the way, if not his oratory, his ability to control a camera and people's attention when he's in front of it. But Bakari Sellers, CNN political commentator and former state representative for South Carolina, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for reaching out, and I hope everybody has a great week and stays safe and healthy.
Well, David, in the last couple of minutes we have, I just wanted to sort of lean on your expertise and experience here and ask you, what do you think viewers should want network coverage to provide for them this week and next week?
You know, I think you want them, you want network executives in some ways to get out of the way and let the speeches play out when there is a moment, when there is something useful being advanced, a point of view, a voice, a rising figure, an influence. You know, sometimes the best sports commentators kind of are quiet, like Vin Scully was for so many decades a commentator for the Dodgers and would let the play out for viewers to experience. And that can be very useful. And then there are times where it says, you know, there's stuff happening here. These words have meaning that go beyond what simply they're stating in the moment. And that's important to tease out and make clear for people. It's as though you're deconstructing a code here. It's not a conspiratorial code, but it's saying these have implications. We want to walk you through them. And really, you know, as you've talked about, get at policy and the meaning and the substance of things. This is, as you said earlier on, an opportunity to do that. Let's go in and serve the viewers as citizens here, not simply people you're selling pharmaceuticals to.
Well, David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent, also On Point's Friday host and editor. David, thank you so much for joining us here today on day one of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Thanks a lot, David.
You bet. Have fun with it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.